The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
As Russia continues its bombardment of Ukraine and its efforts to expand its territory, where does Russia's constant push for territory come from? Well, to answer that question, we have to go right back to the year 1547 and the reign of Russia's first Tsar, Ivan the Terrible, where the seeds of Russia's imperial mindset were first sown. And in that intervening period, the imperial mindset has only grown to where it remains to this day. In a new book called Unfinished Empire, Donika Bachoin takes us through the rise and entrenchment of that imperial mindset. And Donika, who is Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU, joins me now. Donika, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
So let's go back to that early ambition to expand territory and Ivan the Terrible. It's a long time ago and things really haven't changed.
No, well, the remarkable thing is, you know, not that, I guess, Russia expanded, but how far it expanded, because this is in some ways a classic European imperial story. We had many empires, of course, in Europe, but many of them were somewhat landlocked, you know, the French and the Germans, because they were surrounded by other powerful countries. Mm. Most of Russia's initial expansion is eastwards and southwards, and that allows it to extend ultimately from the Baltic Sea to the Pacific Ocean. And as I say in the book, I mean, it starts out with being a country around the size of Albania, so much smaller than Ireland, and it expands between, we'll say, the early 16th century to the early 20th century at a rate, an average rate of 80 square kilometres per day for centuries.
Now, how was it done? Because you do remark in the book that the Russians are not great fighters. Now, we saw Stalingrad and all the rest, so their resistance and their persistence is to be admired, but not great fighters. So what do they do? Just pick easy prey?
Well, it depends on what period of history you're talking about, of course. I mean, the Russian state evolves and has different leaders. So in the early stages, a lot of it is simply the fact that they were encountering, a little bit like European settlers in North America, they were encountering people who had a rich culture, but they didn't necessarily have technological advantages over those who were invading, and that's what made it relatively easy. And of course, there was
the destruction of the Native Americans by Europeans.
Absolutely,
is the same story.
Absolutely, and of course, they indeed meet each other in a way, because of course, the Russian Empire extends to Alaska at one stage, which they sell to the Americans in 1867, and indeed they have a colony in California for some time. But when you talk about the Soviet era, when again, you know, their lack of fighting prowess is obvious, at least initially. Stalin had modernized that region. I mean, Stalin was described as Genghis Khan with a telephone. So he managed to have the advantages of a dictatorship with 20th century technology. And that allows the Russians to have that, I wouldn't say it's a technological edge, but they have the numerical edge always. And that's, of course, evident in today with
now,
the war in Ukraine.
We know with the plantations here that the idea of planting people from another country with another language, another religion, in our case, transformed the island of Ireland. So we became more like them, although we always say they become more Irish than the Irish themselves. There's no doubt that we absorb a lot of what they were. What was the Russian mentality? Was it to impose Russian culture, Russian language on all those territories they conquered?
Yes, it did. That's essentially what it did. So unlike, the British Empire, which we're more familiar with, you know, they had mainly distant colonies, which when they decolonized, of course, they said goodbye in a way that wasn't psychologically traumatizing, because they'd never been part of the centralized political system. Whereas with Russia, each area they colonized became Russia, and therefore Russia became the language. And the eliminationist violence was quite extreme in many parts. If you take, for example, the Circassians, there was the Circassian question in the British media in the 19th century, what would happen to them? Were the Circassians alive today in the region which they predominated, which was around Sochi, which is now, of course, a Russian sea resort? It's estimated they would number about 30 million, but they were wiped out. And those who survived were sent into exile to Turkey. And of course, we have the example of Crimea as well, which is a rather extraordinary one.
Now, there's an ethnic group. They lived there. They owned it. It was their country, the Tatars. Where did they go?
They went, as did the Circassians, to the Ottoman Empire because they were Muslim by religion.
Ethnic cleansing.
I mean, they were wiped out. But it wasn't as effective under Catherine the Great as it was under Stalin. Again, Stalin had that 20th century technological edge. So even though you had large-scale migration in the 18th century, it was left to Stalin in 1944 to move the entire Crimean Tatar population in one weekend to Central Asia. I lived for a year in Uzbekistan. I met the descendants of those Crimean Tatars, and they talked about their relatives just being shoved onto trains, not knowing where they were going, being relieved when they got the knock on the door and told to leave, because they said when they came with guns, they thought, well, at least they're not going to kill us, because they would have killed us immediately, not told us to collect their belongings. But they were all sent to Uzbekistan, and then the next census in 1959, the post-war census, shows for the first time the Russians in a majority in Crimea. So Russia today kind of presents Crimea as this kind of almost ancient part of the Russian Empire.
Not so.
The Russians only become the majority.
But you can see where today's political leaders like Netanyahu can see a justification, although there was no world media to keep an eye on what the Russians were doing to the Tatars in ethnic cleansing them out of Crimea. But this is what Netanyahu is going to do to Gaza, get rid of them, put them somewhere else.
Yeah.
Either kill them or move them.
And you look at the evidence of history from the Russian Empire, it's not encouraging. Look at Finland. Finland lost 10% of its territory, 500,000 people living in the Karelia region. Yeah. I visited Helsinki one time, and I saw the Olympic Stadium that was there for the 1940 Olympics, which never happened, of course, because World War II. But the people who were displaced from the Russian annexation of Finland were moved into those Olympic villages, for example. So no, settler colonialism ultimately paid off, because there was no accountability after the war. They kept the territories that they seized in the settler state where they were.
And this again is what is driving Putin. What I have, I hold, he hopes.
They look at it very much through the long lens. I mean, even during the recent talks in Istanbul with the Ukrainians, the Russians said, look, we fought the Swedes for 21 years. We'll continue indefinitely until we get what we want. Now, they're talking back to the 18th century. So this isn't like Donald Trump, who changes his mind every day of the week. They're taking the long view, and they're in this for the long haul.
Now, they have expanded and contracted, depending on what way the historical winds were blowing. The disintegration of empires, though, I mean, ultimately the Roman Empire collapsed, but for many people, the Roman Empire did represent progress.
It did. We can't say necessarily the same about the Russians, though the Russian narrative is that they brought progress. It's the classic imperial narrative, terra nullius. We encountered territories which had nothing there, or peoples who could not sufficiently derive profit from the area. So we were doing them a favor, essentially, by providing them with this greater civilization. You get that a lot with places like Central Asia in the Caucasus. It's a little bit more complicated when they invade places like Poland or Finland, because they often encounter people who are more educated, and that makes them more troublesome provinces.
So countries that are on the fringes of Russia, I mean the Moldovas, Lithuanians, Latvias, they must feel very nervous about what's going on.
They do. They do feel very nervous. I lived in Moldova for 2 years. I interviewed Maia Sandu, the current president of Moldova, and she's on record as saying that were it not for Ukrainian resistance against the Russian invasion, they would have been next. So Moldova's survival, in her view, depends on Ukraine pushing back Russia. And of course, you look at the Estonians who are in NATO. They now believe that because Donald Trump is questioning the whole idea of a transatlantic security guarantee, that they may go back to where they came from. Because you remember, the Estonians got independence at the same time as Ireland after World War I. It was taken away from them at the beginning of World War II. And now they're feeling for the first time that perhaps they're in that kind of interwar period where perhaps the Russians will come back. There's a 20% Russian minority, ethnic Russian minority, living in Estonia.
And that's one of the techniques of the Russians. I mean, in Ukraine, so many people speak Russian because in the time of the Soviet Union, Russian was taught everywhere. And they understood the effectiveness of language in their colonization.
Absolutely. And again, this is something that's not unique to Russia, but the Russians did, in a way, perfect that your imperialism is all the more deeply embedded when you convince the natives of their own inferiority, that they have to take on the language of the invaded. We saw this, of course, happen in Ireland as well, through much the same methods. You put it through education, you make it impossible to get employment without knowing the imperial language. So yeah, I mean, it's I've noticed, though, a pushback in Central Asia, where I lived for many years, where people are de-Russifying their names. So they're taking off the Ovs and the Ovas at the end of their name, in a little bit way that Irish people kind of Gaelicize their names after independence. So it's not that it's kind of one way or unidirectional, but also in the history books. I mean, the Kremlin surveys the history books of the neighboring countries, seeing how they portray history. Because, of course, if you're to have a narrative that you brought civilization or you liberated your neighbors, you have to get them to buy into that story. And of course, there is a lot of pushback still. And that's one of the reasons. And of course, what does the Kremlin call that? Russophobia.
And of course, Russia is continuing this, the kidnapping of children from Ukraine, for example, a classic example. Get them young and proselytize them.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a really tragic and outrageous situation where not only often these are children of parents who've been killed and they have been, you know, kidnapped and brought in their thousands to Russia to be re-socialized. And they're been teaching them Russian, you know, songs and patriotic mottos and stuff like that. And this is one of the reasons why, indeed, that Vladimir Putin is wanted by the International Criminal Court.
Why does Russia see itself, and you write this in your book, as victim rather than perpetrator?
Well, of course, all countries like to have a positive view of their history. So, you know, I think it's best emblematized in their narrative of the Great Patriotic War, as they called it, which was recently commemorated on the 9th of May. This is the notion that they liberated Europe from fascism. And of course, this is also a narrative that they're now using in Ukraine. They're saying that they're denazifying Ukraine. So this is something with contemporary resonance. And it's of course, based on a fiction because, of course, at the beginning of World War II, Stalin had a pact with Hitler to divide Europe up between them. And that's when you have the Russian invasions of, or the Soviet invasions of Finland, of Romania, of Poland. And but they kind of have this excising of their history so that those 2 years, 1939 to 1941, don't appear anywhere in their kind of national consciousness. Mm. A majority of Russians' opinion polls show don't even know that they invaded Poland in September 1939. The annexation of the Baltic states in 1940s is also not part of their national narrative. Instead, they fast forward to 1941. That's all the statues in villages and towns throughout Russia. They all commemorate only 1941 to 45 because the narrative then is heroic defense against a Nazi invasion and the liberation of Europe.
Mm. The question of being architects of their own destruction, though, I mean, collectivization of farms, an economy that is more devoted to military development and space development than economic development for its ordinary citizens. When you look at the decline of the Soviet Empire, it's down to their own mismanagement.
Yes, but it's very much elite-led. I mean, one key point in the book is that, you know, Russian history is essentially long periods of authoritarian rule punctuated by brief times of troubles, of chaos. And then they have this kind of critical juncture where they could go in another direction. They could democratize. So 1917 was one such moment, 1991 another. But they revert to the authoritarian template. For example, we think it extraordinary that the Soviet Union, you know, collectivized property. But we have to remember that it was only two generations before when serfdom was abolished by the Tsar. So they never really had a tradition of private property. It was going back to where they came from, really.
When I look at what goes on in Hungary and in other countries in Europe where they have a growing right-wing support, which also, strangely enough, is supportive of Putin's Russia, you wonder, how do Europeans in those areas have such short memories of what the Soviet maw did to them?
It's a very good question. Of course, the Red Army went into Budapest in 1956, into Czechoslovakia in 1968. Hungary is really the outlier. It's still remembered in Poland, in Czechia, in Estonia. And that's really because, I guess, you know, they have such a positive economic relationship with Russia. And the value system is closer to the Kremlin's, you know, this kind of false notion of family values, anti-minority, anti-other, anti-LGBT, quite patriarchal. That's much more in common with what Putin is espousing than what Brussels is espousing. So that also kind of acts as a gravitational pull of Hungary towards Russia.
Now, Putin acts with great impunity. Where does that sense of impunity come from in him?
I think it's that he has looked at Russia's previous actions and indeed his own. Remember that this war in Ukraine is his fifth war and he's never been punished for any of them. There's never been any consequences. So the lesson that he comes away with that, you know, you're gambling with other people's lives because let's face it, it's a dictatorship. Your inner circle are never going to suffer the consequences you hope. There is always that risk, though, if you're a dictator, that this war might be the one that brings you down. He looks at Bashar al-Assad. He looks at Gaddafi. He looks at Saddam Hussein. And the reason why he was so upset by those particular overthrows is that they're very similar regimes to the type that he has. And it's one of the reasons why he can never hand over power. I mean, he's going to leave the Kremlin whenever he dies. He has no positive precedent of a transition to someone else.
And whether he dies of natural causes, you know, found by his underlings like Stalin was, or whether he ends up against the wall on a firing squad facing him is a question, and I'd say he ponders that from time to time.
He does. And he knows that wars are unpredictable. And this war, you know, wasn't the 3-day blitzkrieg that he was hoping for. And that's why he's invested so much in this. It's not just the future of Ukraine or indeed the future of Europe that's at stake here, but also Putin's future. And he knows that very well.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's called Unfinished Empire, Russian Imperialism in Ukraine and the Near Abroad. It's published by Agenda Publishing, and Donacha Bachoin, who's Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU, its author. Thank you very much, Donacha, for joining us in studio today.
Thanks very much, Pat.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.